Gelandrina. Beautiful name.
Thank you. My family's Basque. A lot of people don't know what Basque is around here, I guess, but...
what is Basque?
It's like, you've heard of the old country? Like, my grandparents were from Spain, from the old country, from... It's between Spain and France. I guess they say that the Basque people are the most mysterious people in the world. Nobody has DNA like our DNA, because when the people came and passed through, whatever, we didn't branch out with them or whatever. We stayed and only, I guess, we didn't go out and get pregnant and stuff by other people passing through or whatever. We stayed within our little country right there or whatever, I guess. But yeah, my grandparents were both from Spain. My grandpa was a sheep herder. And yeah. But where I'm from, we have Basque restaurants, Basque festivals, Basque dancing, Basque, everything. And
where are you from?
Where I lived. I'm from Wyoming, but a little town in Elko, Nevada. So, growing up, I had a really good childhood. I mean, two parents. I mean, my mom was an alcoholic all her lives. But when I was like probably 10 or 12, I think, she went to work at a daycare center, and she dropped a little kid down the stairs because she went drunk. And the family, because it was a really small town in Wyoming that we grew up in, and they said that, you know, that they wouldn't press charges as long as she went to rehab. So I started staying with my aunt, and my sister started staying with my dad, and my mom went to rehab, and when she came home, I mean, it was great. She had lost like 150 pounds. She was a completely different person, and she was clean and sober for like 16 years. But when I was a junior in high school, we moved from Wyoming to Nevada. Now, in Wyoming, I was prom queen. I was first freshman to ever start varsity volleyball, basketball. I still hold records in the state of Wyoming for several things. And I had scouts looking at me my like seventh and eighth grade year. And I was going to be going into having a full-ride volleyball scholarship. But when we moved to Nevada my junior year, I blew out both of my knees in a game. And so I had surgery on my right leg first. And then I had then my left leg done. And my senior year, I went to go start playing again. And the doctor said that, you know, he didn't think I was ready. So I signed my own release papers. And the day before our first game, this girl came under the net and stepped on my foot, and I blew my knee out again 2 days before our first game. So I had to have another surgery. And that's what really started my addiction with pain pills and all that. And then I tried to go back after my other surgeries or whatever, but I had just met this guy, and he was older than me, like way older than me, like 35, 36, something like that. And I didn't know at the time that he was a drug dealer, but he was selling meth or whatever. And I ended up dropping out of high school, which, I mean, I went back and graduated from the adult high school, but I dropped out of high school, lost my scholarship. I had academic scholarships, everything, lost all of those. And I ran away to Arizona with him. And we were in Arizona for about a year. And then we moved to California, to San Diego. He was working at the Underground Railroad there. And I didn't know at the time, you know, that he was transporting meth like back and forth from Nevada to California. And that, I mean, I was a huge part of that because I was with him all the time. And I was literally the one delivering it because it was my car. It was in my name. It was, you know, I was the one taking it to the people. And I thought, I had no idea that we were delivering meth. But then I was driving one day, and my car broke down. And so I got out, and I went to, I wrote down the exit I was on and everything. Well, we went back to get my car, and it wasn't there. And another tow trucking company had picked it up, and it took me like 6 months to find it. Well, when I found it, there was like everything was torn apart and there, whatever. And I was like, why would they need to take all of this stuff out? And the guy's like, well, we're just wondering why you had hidden compartments and stuff, you know, under your stuff. And I was like, I have no idea. They're like, okay, well, you know, the police want, you know, would like to speak to you, which I never called them, and I moved back to Nevada, so they never, you know, never contacted me or anything. But when we got back to Nevada, we were only supposed to be there for a couple of days at first. We left my car in San Diego and drove a friend's car, a Cadillac that my boyfriend had wanted to buy. And when we get to back to Nevada, my sister, who was, you know, she was heavily into meth as well. And so her and her boyfriend, we moved in with them at a little trailer park. And we were there for about a month. And her baby daddy had gotten pulled over in the Cadillac that we had and had a gun in it. And so we couldn't get it out of the impound, couldn't get none of our stuff out of it or anything. And then he gets arrested. And I guess somebody had wore a wire on him or something. And it was one of my sister's boyfriends or friends or whatever that she introduced us to. So he had called, you know, from the jail or whatever, and was like, you know, telling us, you know, what not to do when we didn't know that they were literally, you know, listening on all of our phone calls and everything. And I mean, I guess I was really naive about, because I had never even drank. I had never tried smoking weed. I had never tried a cigarette. I had never tried anything. I was really, you know, sports and school was my whole life. So I was a really goody two shoes. Like I was a square pretty much. And so I was really, really naive about, you know, the whole meth thing and everything. And so the first time I tried it and stuff, I really, you know, I didn't care for how it made me feel or whatever, but it just numbed me a little bit. So, so I went to go, my sister and I were staying at a hotel, and I went to go visit him right before Christmas. And as I get in to the way or to the visiting and everything, when I gave him my ID and stuff, they were really weird, called an officer up there and stuff. And I kind of started, you know, getting a little paranoid, but I was like, oh, I'm just tripping. So I go in, I'm talking to him and everything. And as I'm leaving, they're like, Ms. Mendoza, please put your hands behind your head and put your coke down. And I was like, what the fuck? And they had a warrant for my arrest for trafficking, sales. I had so many charges I don't even know. And I also didn't know that I had 14 grams of meth on me at the jail in my pants. I just put on a pair of pants because we were staying at a hotel. And so I was on the front page of the paper, a girl trying to smuggle in drugs to her boyfriend, and this whole article. And you know, all these officers, like when I got in the back, all these officers that people that I knew that I had seen on the streets that I had no idea, you know, were cops or whatever. And I was like, what the fuck? I didn't realize, you know, I mean, I guess I knew that there was, you know, undercovers and all of that or whatever. But when I always thought people were tripping when they were talking about that stuff, you know, and because the tiny town that I grew up in, there was, you know, we had the only two stoplights in the entire county. There was like maybe two cops or whatever, you know, there wasn't nothing like that going on there. And that was, you know, my whole life. And so I didn't realize that there really was, you know, undercovers following us and that there was, you know, marked vehicles. I just thought that they were, you know, had been up for too many days. And you know, they told me that my sister, they had a warrant out for my sister's arrest too. So I called her, and she ended up just coming and turning herself in. And I mean, they didn't ask me to talk, because I didn't know anything He's the one, you know, he spoke Spanish. He's the one that did all the dealings and everything or whatever. I just delivered, you know, dropped him off. I didn't say anything to him. I didn't, you know, so I didn't really know anything. But so they were, I had, my bail was $250,000. My parents ended up hiring me an attorney. And then because of the conflict of interest with my sister and my boyfriend, my sister ended up getting the other attorney at my appointed attorney, I mean, the one that we paid for, she ended up getting his appointed attorney. So it kind of worked out like that or whatever. But I was still facing 2 1-5s and a 2-10 or whatever. And I ended up getting released. I mean, my parents had to bail me out. I was in there for like 3 months at this time. And then they bailed me out for like $5,000 cash. And my boyfriend ended up signing some of my charges away or whatever. So he took the charges and they offered him a deal for prison time for him taking, you know, my charges away. And, but I mean, I was still facing, you know, time and everything. Well, when we got out and everything, I mean, my sister and I both got jobs, started working, completely stayed away from everybody. And, they told me, you know, I couldn't have any contact with my boyfriend or anything or whatever, which, you know, he's writing me from prison every day asking me to marry him and this and that. And I didn't even read any of the letters or nothing because I was trying to, you know, be good and stay out of all of that. Well, then one night, right after we got out, somebody shot out my parents' window, one of the windows at our house. And when they called the cops and everything, you know, they were like, I hope they're not, you know, coming after the girls, thinking that they're snitching, you know, something, whatever. And so they had us under like 24-hour surveillance. They had a cop down the street making sure that they weren't trying to come, you know, do something or whatever, thinking that one of us snitched or that my boyfriend snitched or something. It ended up being just a couple kids that were going by and fucking shooting a BB gun, which that was lovely for that, whatever. But then about a week later, I was downtown. I worked at one of the casinos, and I met this really cute guy or whatever, and he asked if I wanted to go to dinner or whatever. So we went to go to dinner, but as we're going to go to dinner, he is not going, like, towards the restaurant. And I'm like, you know, but there's a language barrier because he still spoke mainly Spanish. And so I'm like, wait, where are you going? And he's going towards the place where my boyfriend used to always pick up. And I'm like, no, like, I don't want to go here. I don't want to be here, whatever. And he's like, no, it's okay. And but it wasn't okay. I guess my boyfriend had owed them a lot of money. And so the boss was like, well, it needs to be paid off, you know, so she's going to have her start working or whatever, and until it's paid off. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. And they're like, well, you don't really have a choice. Your boyfriend owes us a lot of money, and whether he got, you know, arrested and isn't here, then somebody needs to pay it. So they took me to some, like, little ranch, like, somewhere out in the middle of Nevada. I had no idea where we were at, whatever. And I don't even know how long I was there, like maybe a month or two. And they would just have guys come out there and then once the debt was paid off, they didn't want to let me go. And I'm like, you guys promised that I could leave once it was paid off. And they're like, well, you made us a lot of money. Like, we want to work out something with you. I'm like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be doing this. And So it was probably another 2 weeks, and there was this young kid that they would always have watch me during the day, and I would just beg him to let me go. And one day, I think because he just felt so bad for me, because I would just cry and cry. And one day he left the door unlocked, and I just took off running. He fell asleep, and I never looked back, but I felt like I was walking forever, and it was out in the middle of nowhere. I would thought for sure that somebody, that they were going to start pulling up in a vehicle. And after that, I was so scared. I'm like, well, they know where I live. They know where my parents live. But like right after I left, like a week later, I didn't go home. I just went to a friend's house. And but like a week later, there was a thing in the paper, and the head guy, he had gotten busted. And so they arrested him, and they had him in, and then he got deported. And so I never saw him again, thank God. He was the one that was always, was like, no, you're not leaving. We're not going to let you go, whatever. But the other guys, like, I saw them a couple times, but they just, you know, they never said anything to me. They just kind of looked the other way, you know? And every day I thought for sure somebody was going to come get me again and pick me up, because I'm like, they're not just going to let me leave. They're not just going to let me go.
And going like to the police was not an option?
No, because I was so scared that my boyfriend was in prison and that they were going to do something to him if they found out that my parents just thought that I ran away again. Because I didn't want something to happen to them. And so after that, I stayed clean and sober for like 10 years or something like that. And then I have a bone disease. And I was a personal trainer after that I went and got my certification to be a personal trainer. And I had a kickboxing class at the college, and I was just at class one day, and I just dropped to the ground, and my students called 911, and I found out that I have something wrong with, like, every single disc in my back, all the way from my C1 down to my S1. It's either bulging, degenerative, or herniated on every single disc. And the doctor's like, we honestly don't know how you've even been walking, partially because your discs are so gone. There, it's just because I was pinching a nerve, but the feeling was going out in my legs, and I was becoming partially paralyzed. Like, I would have to go into the hospital, they'd give me a shot or whatever, but the feeling would stay like that for weeks. Sometimes I wouldn't be able to, you know, feel my feet hardly. I would just be pins and needles. And they had misdiagnosed me at first. And then when they diagnosed me with something called a Chiari malformation. And the third stage of Chiari is permanent paralysis. When they misdiagnosed me, it was at the early stages of stage one. And when they diagnosed me, I had progressed to the early stages of stage two. And it's where I have a 6-inch gap from where my head's connected to my spinal column, and my brain comes down and puts pressure on my spinal cord, and it causes paralysis because it literally, like, your discs are gone, and it ends up, like, crushing your spinal cord pretty much because of the pressure, whatever. So I was supposed to have surgery and have my brain decompressed. But I was going through a divorce with my first husband, and Medicaid wouldn't cover the procedure. And so I just never went and had it done, and I've been dealing with problems with that for like 10, 12 years now. And so I got off the pain pills and everything, whatever, for like 10 years. But every time I would get off of them, something would happen. I'd break a bone, or I would do something to where I would have to be put back on them again or whatever. I would try to not take them and stuff, but something always led me back to pain pills, which is what my addiction started with in the first, you know. I would do good for 5, 10 years, and then something would happen with my back, because I was I was really athletic and always doing sports or coaching one of my kids' teams or something. But every time I turned around, I was bedridden because I would throw something out in my back or my fucking ankles. I have screws in both my ankles, both my knees, an artificial disc in my lower back, pins in my elbow and my wrist. This finger is nothing but a pin and a rod. And so it's like, there's a legit reason, you know, that I was on painkillers, but it was never enough. So I would sell my pills and go buy heroin. And because the heroin would take away the pain and take away everything else, you know. And then my doctor got arrested. And so I, instead of going in, because I have, like I said, I have legit reasons, you know, to be on them. I could have just went and got another doctor. But instead I just, you know, started, you know, smoking heroin again, just 100%. And it was just the ups and downs with everything. And just dealing with, you know, past issues and past whatever, you know, just trying to cover that up. Yeah, so, I mean, even when I was clean and sober, like, every single day, all day, that's all would run through my mind, just thinking about it constantly. And I mean, I would be working, I would have a good job, I would have my kids, my family, you know, but something all day, every day just would consume me, you know, thinking about being in pain and fucking dealing with that, that even when I was off of the medication, I would go buy alcohol or something, a couple shots before I went to work. I would have to take it or I would just be shaking all day. And that's all I could think about. And then when I got on fentanyl, then it really, I mean, somebody asked me, what does it make you feel like? And I told them, it makes me feel nothing. Like, well, why would you want to smoke? And I said, no, it makes me feel nothing. Like, it numbs me to everything. And just with everything, just trying to cover up all the shit that has happened and all the shit that I've fucked up in my life. Just not wanting to feel that. And I, you know, I am not from around here. I got left here like about a year ago. And, but I haven't even really tried to get home, you know. I mean, I pretty much know if there's anything that I try to do, I can succeed at it one way or another, but when I don't even try to do anything. And so like, I haven't even tried to get home. I haven't tried to contact my family. I haven't tried to do any of that.
You're living on Skid Row now?
Yeah.
You're in a tent or just?
Yeah. Well, I've had a couple tents, but when I leave during the day, they constantly get stolen. So right now I don't have a tent. I just kind of bounce around because I had all my bags. And 2 days ago, I had them in a trailer. And next thing I know, I literally put them in the trailer. I walk around the corner. I turn around and the whole entire trailer is caught on fire. It was a little RV right there by a tent. Somebody had thrown. Some girl threw a fucking little thing inside because I guess one of the guys hit her or something like that. And so she burnt the whole RV down and everything, and I had all my bags with everything I have. Like, this is what I'm wearing. I've been in for like 4 days now, because I have nothing.
And, and your drugs now are fentanyl and probably meth?
No, just fentanyl and crack.
Mm. The crack keeps you up.
Yeah, and ever since, like, I never had smoked crack, or I guess they call it caffeine now. I had never smoked that before, but I started smoking it a couple months ago, and since I started smoking that, I don't smoke meth at all. I haven't smoked meth in months, and my fetty intake has gone down, like, drastically, because, I mean, my caffeine intake has gone up, but I figure, you know, maybe the lesser of the two evils, because the withdrawals from caffi I could handle, you know? So the fentanyl, I'm still going through withdrawals, you know, if I don't have it or whatever, but it's nothing like what it was before. I don't wake up panicking and in sweats when I haven't smoked for a couple hours and stuff, you know? But,
How are you making money now?
I'm working on the streets, just doing dates and stuff, which, I got raped really bad, a couple months ago. And the guy, like, had ripped me open so bad that they had to put stitches in. I couldn't walk for like a month. And so now, like, it's hard for me to do dates. It's really hard. But
I don't mean to be so personal, but had to put stitches in because what?
Because he had ripped me open so bad. I would only do anal. I hadn't had sex in my vagina in like 6 years. And just because I'm really small and it hurt, you know, I don't remember losing my virginity hurting that bad, but it hurts too bad to have sex. And so I hadn't had sex in like 6 years, but he had gave me something in my drink or something or whatever. And I woke up, I was just bleeding everywhere. And when I went in, they said I got ripped open so bad.
Because he was so big?
Yeah. And so they had to put stitches in there, kind of like when you know, if you have get ripped open when you have a kid. But I've had all C-sections, so I haven't had to have, you know, any through. But so I couldn't walk for about a month after that. And now it's like, I mean, he fucked me up bad. Like, I sometimes just even, you know, just touching it or whatever, like I jump because it's just sensitive, you know. So it's really hard for me to do dates and stuff right now. The guys don't understand that, you know. I don't like to bring that up or whatever, but they're like, oh, why can't you? Are you a transvestite? Do you have AIDS? Do you have ethnicity? And I'm like, no. Well, then let me try. And I'm like, okay,
you can try. Are you using condoms when you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Can I ask what you charge for something like this? On Skid Row?
$50 for a blowjob, $120 to fuck, and that's on Skid Row. And they don't even like paying that much.
That's a lot for Skid Row.
Yeah, it is. I mean, almost every time I tell them that, they're like, oh, we don't. And I'm like, I'm not giving you a blowjob for $10, $20. You can.
Yeah, I've heard.
Yeah.
For $5.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And I'm like, are you really going to, I mean, disrespect me that much at pulling over and asking me to, if you could give me some food stamps for a fucking. And not even food stamps. They want to buy you a drink or something to get. And it's like,
You want to see men treating women at their absolute worst.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Go to Skid Row.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the truth.
It's got to be so depressing.
Yeah.
For you to just be living this life now.
Yeah.
Does your family know where the situation you're in?
No. There's a missing persons report out for me. But I don't want to go home or call them until I get clean. And so I plan on going to detox, but I've been planning on that for like a year now. I just haven't made it yet. So I don't know. I really am ready to go to detox. I just haven't. I really, every time I get a phone and get myself situated, it gets stolen. But I fall asleep, and so it's like, every time I get a step ahead, something happens and I fall two steps back and I'm like, well, maybe I'm not meant to go right now or whatever. And that's my reasoning, you know, as an addict. Maybe, you know, that's why it happened, because I'm not supposed to go right now or whatever, which I know is the stupidest thing ever. But me reasoning with myself is what I come to the conclusion, so that I just, you know, can prolong it a little more. But I really, like, I don't have any way to use the internet or to get online, you know, to make calls or anything, because every time I get a phone, somebody steals it. And it's like, even when I had my own tent, whatever, I fucking would, if I fell asleep there at all by myself or whatever, it was inevitable that I woke up and my stuff would be gone. So, and I really don't, you know, I don't hang out with too many people, honestly. I pretty much am by myself for the most part. I don't, you know, have any girlfriends down there or anything. And of course, I mean, the guy friends that I do have there, you know, it's not really friends, you know, it's, they all want something else, you know, and it's like, there are a few of them, you know, that have helped and looked out for me and made sure, you know, that my shit doesn't get jacked and stuff when I'm not out, whatever. But for the most part, every single time I come up or anything, something else knocks me back down.
If you look back at your story, at your whole life, mm-hmm. is there one thing that may have, like maybe the knee injury when you were playing volleyball, if that hadn't happened, may have this...
Yeah. Honestly, I don't like to think of it like this because I don't want to blame my dad, but everything was so good when we were living in Wyoming, and then everything when we moved up to Nevada, everything just fucked up. I mean, I hate to, you know,
What would you say was the biggest factor? Was it moving to Nevada, or was it the knee injury?
Well, it kind of happened at the same time. I had had injuries before in Wyoming or whatever, but I was so, like, dedicated to my sports and stuff that it didn't matter what. I mean, I played in a state championship with two broken ankles because it didn't matter. I was going to, you know, play and I was going to come out on top or whatever. When in Nevada, I didn't really have anybody holding me to anything or whatever. I didn't have my coach. You know, I didn't have the connection with my coaches like I had in Wyoming. I didn't have anybody, you know, holding me accountable for the stuff I was doing or whatever. And so when me being the person I am, I know that if I was in Wyoming and I had my knee blown out, I would have found a way to work through it or to play with my hurt knee. We're in Nevada. I just met my boyfriend. I just tried meth for the first time. That was my reasoning for not, you know, not pushing through and holding, you know, myself accountable for what I was doing. It was giving myself a break for one. That's what I thought. It's like, you have your whole life have constantly, you know, been on number one, been this and that, whatever, that maybe you just need a little bit of a break. And fuck, I wish I wouldn't have given myself that break, because I've done nothing but give myself that break ever since.
How old are you now?
42. I'll be 42 in August.
And you have how many kids?
Five.
Five kids. Where are they?
They're with, well, my... My 10-year-old was killed a couple years ago, but my other kids are with their dad in Nevada. My oldest is in Washington with her boyfriend, and then my youngest is 12. He's the only one that's really with my ex, and the other ones are all older. They're 23, 21, and 20. So,
how'd you lose one of your kids?
His best friend accidentally shot him.
Oof.
And, And then my mom died 3 months later. And then my dad started dating one of my best friends. And my husband cheated on me all within, boom, like a couple months. And
this was when you were in Nevada?
Yeah. So that right there, like, you know, after that happened, everybody else, you know, kind of all moved on because they had their own lives, you know, which I'm not mad at any of them for that. But I went from having a house, a family, a vehicle, a job, you know, whatever, to when my husband cheated on me and I moved back in with my parents, and then my mom died. My dad sold the house, didn't say anything. I had nowhere else to go. So I was out on the streets. And I had never, you know, I had never been, I had always had a house or of, you know, my parents' house to be able to go back to. And then when my mom died and my dad sold the house, whatever, I didn't have that anymore, you know? And it's like they all went on with their lives, you know, as they should. But I didn't.
Chi-Chi, let me ask you one last question. What would you say is the most important lesson you've learned in all of this?
That you should hold yourself accountable for everything that you do, giving yourself a break, and not being accountable for stuff that you should definitely be accountable for or whatever. Because we always, you know, want to take the easy way out or whatever. Most of us, especially in addicts' minds, you know. But you should always just, I don't know, that really isn't. Just not to give up on yourself, I guess.
All right, Chi-Chi, I hope you figure out a way to get away from the fentanyl.
Yeah.
Or the crack. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.